Born in the Shetland Islands in 1953, Ian Berenson was destined to be a musician from a young age. When he was only 6 years old, he took the money he'd saved and bought his first guitar. And from the time he picked it up, he began a journey which has not ended yet. In the 70s, he was a founding member of Pilot, the group that brought us the hit singles Magic and January. In 1976, he played on Alan Parsons' first album, Tales of Mystery and Imagination, and has been on every record since. During the last 20 years, he's also been a highly sought-after session guitarist, playing with a diverse range of artists from Kate Bush to Kenny Rogers, Chris de Burgh to John Anderson. Ian joins us from his home in England to discuss the 1984 Keats album. Ian, who was the driving force in getting this project together?
The thing that got this band happening was the fact that Stuart, David, myself, that's, you know, drums, bass, guitar, we had played with the Alan Parsons Project for a while. Eric Wolfson was actually the person who played a big part in getting this together, because he didn't want to obviously give us a slice of his cake, but this was our opportunity to have our cake, to start a band and create a career for ourselves in that respect.
Now, you've worked with so many great singers and musicians over the years. How was the final band lineup determined?
The lineup of the band was pretty much controlled by Eric. He chose, obviously the three of us were in it, but he chose Pete Bardens and Colin Blunston. He chose them for reasons that on paper were perfect. I mean, Pete's a very good writer. Colin's got a very distinctive voice. So on paper, this whole band looked great because we all had track records for writing success. But I think the approach possibly was too much a calculated business approach on paper rather than looking for a band that really bonded and gelled and worked out that way.
Let's talk for a moment about your songwriting. When you wrote Hollywood Heart, is it true that you'd never been there?
Yes, it is. I had never been to Los Angeles. I'd been to America prior to that, but I'd never been across to the West Coast. And it was just one of these things. I started writing this song and these words came to me and I made it all about Hollywood. But as I was completing the lyrics for that song, I remember completing large portions of it in the restaurant in Abbey Road Studios. I kept asking Alan, you know, when you see the Hollywood sign, are you on a hill or are you in a valley or, you know, does this make sense, you know? So he was kind of giving me a mental map of what it looked like. I know it sounds ridiculous, but, you know, there's plenty of people who dream about Hollywood. You don't have to have been there. I've been there since.
The song that took the place of Hollywood Heart on the original U.S. release was Give It Up. And what inspired you to write this track?
I can't find Give It Up. I thought it was dropped. And also I only found out sort of mid-95 that Hollywood Heart wasn't on the original US release. And I can't tell you, I was really upset by that because I really like it. I think it's a good song. And Give It Up was not such a good song. And it was the one that we kind of went, well, this one's surplus. We've got one too many songs, so let's take that off. So it was never as good a song, and it's also kind of a caustic, you know, having a go at someone's song. I'm not telling you who I'm having a go at or anything, but I can't even find the song. I can't recall the whole lyric or anything. So out of the two, no, I preferred Hollywood Heart.
The other song you wrote for this record was called Ask No Questions. On this track, you also play piano and bass. And why did you play bass instead of David? And why don't we hear more of your bass playing?
Well, you do actually hear some of my bass playing from time to time. For example, on Limelight, an Alan Parsons track, David played bass on that. But after he'd left and gone home, I was in doing guitar solo and bits and pieces like that. And at the very end of the song Limelight, there's that kind of piece where the tempo disappears, you know, it's just before the last line, after all the years of waiting, da-di-da-di-da, that stuff. And Alan said, oh, we need something in these gaps. So we hired a fretless bass, and I played the bass licks in between these bits. I've also played bass on many other things. I've played bass on some Pilot records. And the reason you do that is just sometimes it's feel. Each person has an individual feel and an approach to something. And the reason I ended up playing not only bass but piano on that song was it was my song. I'd done a very sort of vibey demo of it, and everyone liked the feel of the demo. And I sort of passionately attacked the piano and got the feel that way. You know, why not really? If it had been an open part, you know, and like, you know, well, we've got this little song, let's expand on it, then it's different. But in this case, it was quite simple. You know, we wanted to reproduce the original demo the way I'd written it. So I just clonked away and twanged away, and that was that.
Now, on Walking on Ice, you're credited with playing a BBC Model B computer flight simulator. What's the story behind this?
This is a little bit of humor creeping in. I think Alan wrote up the sleeve notes. I think he did. Every album, every project, I know I'm keep going back to Parsons Project albums, but every album had a kind of a theme to it. And you remember, like, what were we into at that time? When we did, for example, when we did A Turn of a Friendly Card, we did that in Paris. And David Stewart and myself, we all had cameras, and cameras with different lenses, and we were into, let's take nice shots, good shots, arty-farty shots, and things like that. And we, you know, not with the intention of becoming great photographers, but just you know, shared interests, you know. And the computer thing, that was one, I can't remember which album it was, but there was a stage where Abbey Road number 3 had all the instruments set up, and then it had a corner where I had a BBC B computer set up. Alan had one. I don't know if he brought his in or not. And David had a Commodore set up. And we would write computer programs, and we'd create, you know, little pieces of graphics, play flight simulators or whatever on them in all the downtime. Because obviously when there's a whole band there, you don't work the whole time. And it could be anything going on. If you're not required to play, you've got to amuse yourself. So we amused ourselves. And hence, I probably was spending more time on the computer than I should have.
Who came up with the name for the band? And is it true it wasn't inspired by the famous poet?
No, it wasn't inspired by John Keats, the famous poet. It was inspired by his brother, Pete. No, I lie. Keats was the name of Eric's favourite restaurant, and he wanted to call it that, call the band that. And whilst it was maybe a slightly pompous name or whatever, it maybe has a little romance to it, it was okay. We went along with that. Lucky in a way that his favourite place wasn't, you know, Fat Bob's Cafe or the Bombay Curry Emporium. Doesn't quite roll off the tongue as well as Keats, does it? So there you go. A band called after a restaurant. The restaurant's gone now too. Okay, thanks very much. Enjoy listening to this. I look forward to hearing this on CD. I've only got a scratchy old vinyl copy, which I haven't listened to for a long time. So I look forward to hearing it. Thank you.
Alan Parsons began working at Abbey Road Studios in 1967. While he was there, he was assistant engineer on the Beatles' Abbey Road. He engineered Pink Floyd's classic Dark Side of the Moon. And in the 70s, his production credits would include the first two albums by Pilot and Al Stewart's Year of the Cat. In 1976, he had released the first of many albums as the Alan Parsons Project. Now as a solo artist, he has two albums and a world tour under his belt. And today, he takes a look back at one of his past production projects. Alan, what was your motivation to do the Keats album?
I think the main motivation for doing the Keats album probably came from Eric Wolfson, possibly in response to a slight unhappiness on the part of the band members who had always been rather pushed into the background with the Alan Parsons Project. It was seen as an opportunity to get their names out front with a band of their own. And it consisted of Stuart Elliott, Ian Benson, and David Payton, the mainstay of the rhythm section of the Alan Parsons Project band. And they teamed up with Colin Blunstone and Pete Bardens. I think it was very sort of satisfying for everybody, because they were, you know, happy being in control of something for the first time. Obviously, it gave me an opportunity to do something a little bit different outside the Parsons Project.
Obviously, you were using Abbey Road during this period, and what technology were they using at that time?
The technology was 24-track analog, as I remember, probably mixing to a digital two-track stereo format. But it was a slightly stagnant period for technology. You know, digital multi-track really wasn't, was just around the corner. So 24-track analog was pretty much the normal thing, and of course, digital effects were available. You know, I suppose I used the technology to the full. There were a lot of, I think it could be said that the main areas of development in music at the time were more in the areas of keyboard technology and MIDI and so on, rather than any particular recording technology that Abbey Road would have been responsible for.
From the eyes of the producer, what category did you see Keats fitting into?
I think I saw them fitting into a kind of category that Alan Parsons Project would fall into. I didn't see them as being totally different, perhaps a little bit more on the commercial side. I think we were looking hard to get a single that would be radio friendly, as it were. But I think everybody hoped that that they would fit into the same kind of market as the projects had.
Now, don't you think Turn Your Heart Around would have had better hit potential?
Everyone was very hopeful that Turn Your Heart Around would be a hit single. We actually went as far as making a fairly pricey video for it. Yeah, I mean, of course it was. I mean, it always comes as a disappointment when something fails to reach the charts, but I think everybody was very hopeful.
During this period, the whole gang was also involved in making Ammonia Avenue and Lady Hawk. And how did everyone balance the different productions?
You've reminded me that all these things were happening at the same time. I don't particularly remember there being any confusion between the projects. I remember Lady Hawk was a fairly intense period because there was a deadline. We pretty much went start to finish on that. So as far as I know, there was no doing Ammonia Avenue or Keats in between times. I mean, but it's something I used to do quite a bit. Especially when I was an engineer in the earlier days, I would be working on, four or five albums at once, and it's not usually a problem.
Most of your fans will recognize the Keats band members from your many project albums. Pete Bardens, however, had never been on an Alan Parsons Project album. How did this ex-Camel member get the call?
Pete had been doing work with Colin, as far as I know, and that's really why he was put forward for the job as keyboard player. I obviously knew of his work with Camel, and it seemed like a good idea. He was obviously a very important part of the writing team. A lot of the material was written by Pete. So he was an integral part of the Keats outfit.
On the topic of players, this was also about the same time that Richard Cottle came into the fold. Was this the first album both of you worked on together, and how did you find him?
My memory fails me on the exact time that Richard and I first got involved. I think it was probably Ammonia Avenue. It seemed like a good idea to not only have the keyboard skills of Pete. It seemed, that we needed somebody who was really, really into the technology of keyboards. And Richard was a real sort of whiz kid in that respect. He knew you know, a lot about how to get sounds and how to, you know, hook lots of synths together and make really good sounds. And that was possibly a weakness of Pete's. He wasn't particularly strong on the sounds aspect. It worked out really well, the combination of Pete and Richard playing together on the album.
Now, on the track Avalanche, you're credited with Lynn Cabasa and Timecode. What can you tell us about that?
Lynn Cabasa and Timecode, yes, I suppose it was a little bit of a joke. The fact is that the Lynn Cabasa is actually a machine-generated thing which drives the whole song along, and Timecode is the technology that allows you to sync up a drum machine, which is where this Cabasa sound was coming from. Timecode allows you to sync it up to the tape in the first place. So really, it's just a sort of undercover way of saying that I was doing all things technical on this track. And of course, it actually went for the whole album.
Thanks a lot, Alan, for talking with us. You've given us a lot to think about as we listen to the Keats album.